Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Brooks Miller, Executive Vice President of Creator Marketing at Edelman and United Entertainment Group. Last week, Americans went to the polls to vote for the next president. Donald Trump won the race and is set to return to the White House. Over the last few months, you probably heard someone say this election is unlike any other. One reason for that, social media and internet culture played a bigger role than ever before. Now that the campaign and election are behind us, I wanted to unpack the influence of culture with Dr. Marcus Collins, a clinical professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and author of best-selling book, For the Culture. Marcus, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited for this conversation.
Me too. I mean, you have a lot of knowledge in this space, but in a recent Forbes article, you argued that vibes would likely determine the Trump versus Kamala Harris election. So a couple of things. First, what do you mean by vibes? And now that we are on the other side of this election, do you feel like that was the case?
Yes, for sure. To the latter, but let's start with the former. Vibes. Vibes are the feelings that we have. They're the subjective translation of the environment that we're in, the people that we're around, the scenario we find ourselves in. It's what we feel. And the argument I made was that, you know, we will pick a candidate based on the way we feel about them, not about the rational argument with regards to policy. People hear that go, no, Marcus, no. Like, I care about the policies, and the policies inform how I feel about the person. And to that, I'd say, well, that's very ambitious for you to think that way, but nothing about ourselves as a species have ever been fully driven by rational decisions. We aren't rational human beings. We're rationalizing human beings. We make decisions based off of what we feel, and then we post hoc rationalize them based on the data available to us. So because we make most of our decisions in life as such, why would voting be any different, especially considering the fact that we only vote at most every 2 years? It's not a thing that we do very often. And while we may be inundated with political messaging, we aren't tasked with putting those things into action only every couple of years. So I'd say we're not very good at this, and therefore we're more inclined to rely on our feelings, intuitions, the vibes more than any other time, just like anything else. Do I feel like that was the case in this situation? Absolutely. And we saw this in the way people justified their decisions. You know, they'd say, you know, I voted for him because of his stance on the economy, and I didn't feel that she had a good hold on the economy. Well, the economy empirically is like the darling of the world. It is empirically better than it's been in quite a long time. More jobs. People say, well, I don't feel it. I'm not feeling it. It's like, well, there you go, vibes. And therefore, we voted for the people that was most representative of what we felt.
Yeah, it's so true. It reminds me almost of, I think this is from car advertising, but there's data to support that the more expensive and or important the decision, almost the more the emotional portion of your brain is what's actually pulling the yes or the no, which kind of translates to this too. It's wild.
The literature tells us this, particularly the behavioral economics literature and the psychology literature, is that the more infrequent we do a thing, the more we rely on intuition, what we feel. It's like when you go buy a house, you go, oh, I can see myself living here. And that's what drives our willingness to want to buy that house. Well, how often do you buy a house? Not that often. How often do you buy a car? Not that often. They aren't part of our normal behavior. Therefore, we typically rely on how we feel to inform our behaviors. And we do this anyway. So you can imagine when it's infrequent, just how disproportionate the vibes are.
You're blowing my mind. I have never attributed that behavior with frequency. It has always been around cost. Going back to the politics angle of this conversation of vibes, do you think that vibes have always been important? Or someone like Donald Trump, who has such an emotionally driven campaign strategy and has since 2016, I feel like he's a very emotional forward candidate. Do you think he changed the game?
I think that he may have made the game more exacerbated, but I think that's always been the case. We've seen in the political landscape, people lean one way or the other based upon what they felt. I mentioned this in the Forbes article. When Richard Nixon and JFK were having the first televised debate, the feedback after the debate, people go, oh man, Richard Nixon, you know, he seemed like he wasn't feeling well. Like he kept wiping his head because he was sweating because the cameras were so hot. People were like, I don't want a sick president. No, thank you. And you go, are you kidding me? like, I don't want a president with a cold. Mm-mm, no way. As if that's not a normal thing. That it's ridiculous. It's rationally ridiculous. But we've seen presidential candidates do this really well and succeed in very, very, very remarkable ways. I think before Trump, there was Barack Obama. You know, Barack Obama came to the stage of action and said, hey, people, we'll have an issue with legislation. We'll have an issue with ideas. The issue we have is that people think the government is broken. There's cynicism. And therefore, he ran this idea of hope that together, collectively, we can. And people said, I agree with that. I'm with that. That's my guy, voting for him. Even though on paper, he was a junior senator. You know, he didn't have very much experience in the way of politics, but they voted for him, not because he was a black man. If anything, that was like actually counting against him. But they voted for him because the vibes, they felt it. And then 2016, Donald Trump gets on the stage of action and says, we've gone too far. We need to go back to a day that's not specific, but back to a time when these people had more economic power. These people had more social power, more political power, so on and so on and so on. People go, yes, absolutely. That's my guy. Give me that. You fast forward to today, well, last week, Vice President Kamala Harris preached the gospel that we need to go forward. That we are rolling back the rights and people's agency over their body. Like, that's not who we are, who we want to be. We need to go forward. And freedom is the pathway forward. And I think what we saw here in the election is that more people believed in the orthodoxy or the manner in which Donald Trump saw the world than we did Kamala Harris. And as a result, the presidential election swung in his favor, which leads us to a place here that the vibes are very much aligned with the way President-elect Donald Trump sees the world. I think there we see that if we were to line up the rational arguments, that the empirical rational arguments, even from an economics perspective, like every economics thought leader would tell you that the approach to increasing tariffs will destroy the economy. But people go, that's the move. Didn't even know what tariffs are, but you're like, bring those tariffs here because of the vibes. This is who we are. We are not rational human beings, rationalizing human beings. Our emotions drive the dominant number of decisions we make on a regular basis. And we use facts, data to rationalize decisions that we already want to make.
Yeah, I think it's Brené Brown who always says, we're not thinking machines that have feelings. We're feeling machines that occasionally think.
Exactly.
And that ladders up, yeah, exactly to what you're talking about, the current vibes of a large majority of the country seem to feel scarcity. We got to retain. Progression is not on the agenda. That's for people who have all their ducks in a row. I need to be able to buy milk. I need to be able to pay my bills. And I think that's an interesting way to look at the world. It's very reflective of the vibe. Yeah.
And it certainly begs a question, was that we'd see the post-rationalization of, I don't like the guy. I don't like what he says. I think that these things are wrong. I don't. However, the gas prices are too high. However, eggs are too expensive. However, and there's the economic argument. And to that I go, I hear you. Totally. 1,000%. But the question I can't help but ask is, what's the cost of civility?
Okay, I'm going to switch us from vibes to podcasts. We're on one right now, so they must be important, right? Both presidential candidates really embrace podcasts in a way that I certainly don't remember from 2020 or 2016, definitely not. Kamala Harris sat down with Alex Cooper on Call Her Daddy. That's the most listened by women podcast in the world. Donald Trump did a 3-hour interview with Joe Rogan on the Joe Rogan Experience, which actually ended up leading to Joe Rogan endorsing him. why are podcasts so important now? Why are these where candidates are going, and why are these the mediums that they're choosing?
Because it's the media of the day. It's the contemporary media of the day. You know, in 2007, 2008, Barack Obama used this thing called the interwebs and social media. Oh, Facebook. Have you heard of it? Those were considered contemporary and novel to the institution of politics because politics had always used a traditional means of communications. And then when we saw it being used in 2016 by Hillary, we go, okay, that's not, there's nothing novel to that. Even through Donald Trump, there was nothing novel to that because that then became just the form in which people engaged with and consumed content. Today, in 2024, you know, much of our media diet, a healthy real estate in our media diet comes from podcasts, right? And therefore, if I spend so much of my time, effort, and energy consuming content from here, then this becomes a very compelling place for political messages to be delivered. And I think in the case of Joe Rogan, for instance, and you call her daddy, for instance, you find politicians, in the case of Trump and of Kamala Harris, sort of stripping off their political veneer and being much more human. And the media requires that. The media of podcasts, as opposed to social networking platforms and traditional television, like there's not a lot of facade that are able to be projected. To keep it up for 3 hours, that's tough. You know, that's a tough call. But 8 minutes, I could be my best self. 1 hour, I could be my best self. You know, it'll be tough, but I could do it. You find a host that can sort of disarm you of your political fashioning, your political posturing, I think you get to more truth. You get to more honesty. You see the person behind the veil, if you will. And that makes for podcasts to be a very compelling place for people to get to know who this potential candidate is.
Yeah. We even have trust study data from our Trust Institute at Edelman that supports two things that I'm thinking about as you say that. One, there's just declining trust in these traditional institutions like media and government, which is ironic in the context of what we're talking about. But increasingly, people are turning to people. And you know, I work with influencers and creators. That's my day job outside of being a podcast host with you. But we really boil it down to people trust people. And part of that trust is, and I think personally, the reason why podcasts have really exploded is that parasocial relationship that you really bond with these hosts that you have in your ears or playing on your speakers inside your house for long form content. And so when you have a candidate that comes onto that podcast, you really trust that your best friend has Kamala Harris on her podcast. And you're like, well, if my best friend, Alex Cooper, likes this candidate, let me give her a listen. Another thing I think about, too, in terms of media strategy and why, I mean, I know none of these candidates didn't appear on television. That would be outrageous. But it is notable. I think something like 39% of people report that they ingest more social media than they do television and creator social media. So people like Alex's podcast, Joe Rogan's podcast. I mean, they're watching TikToks more than they're watching TV, if that's, you know, to say it plainly. So I think like strategically, it makes total sense. And I totally hear you on, you know, the reasons why these are really humanizing platforms for these candidates. You can't keep it up an act for 3 hours. Who could?
That's right. I mean, and it's the, even the aesthetic of the media feels much more natural. For instance, you know, when you are on ABC, bright light cameras, good, and everything is postured and beautifully positioned. But in some of these podcasts, you like in someone's living room. You know, it feels like you said, like I'm on Marcus's podcast and he's interviewing someone in his crib. There must be some level of relationship between him and his guests that I give credence that I normally wouldn't give to a media outlet because of that erosion of trust. And you're right. People trust people. People trust people more than any form of marketing, communication, whether it's television, print, out-of-home, radio. People trust strangers more than they trust marketers. So when that person curates an experience for discourse, dialogue with this candidate, you go, oh man, you're already in a place of credence. You're already in a place of trust. So I get to see that person, that candidate, be the best version or the most real version of himself, not as representative, but themselves. And they had the added credence of the person interviewing whom I trust. Then that trust gets transferred over to them.
Yeah, I agree. I want to talk more about the social of it all. I'm so glad you mentioned Obama specifically. That was my first presidential election in which to vote. And I remember being so excited as elder millennial that he was embracing Twitter. That was like so notable to me and meant so much to me as a young person who was really active on those platforms. Obviously, there's been an evolution and we've talked about that too. I think this has been really notably to me the most TikTok-centric election that we've had. Obviously, there was a part of it in 2020, but TikTok hit its highest MDAUs in 2021. That was this election to me. I really want to hear from you. Do you have any moments, social-centric moments, that stand out to you from these campaigns on either side? And we can also include the Biden campaign in this, because that was half the year.
Part of it.
More than, honestly, 75% of the year. Yeah.
That's right. I think for me, a major push happened when Kamala Harris stepped in as the Democratic presidential candidate. And it was the memetics of it all that really got me going.
Memetics?
Yeah, it's like all the memes that were happening, like making tons of memes. And it wasn't just like the memes of let me get ready to gear up, but it was also the memetics of like women for Harris, gays for Harris, white men for Harris. Like these are all like derivative works of each other. And the amassing of derivative works became different doors by which people saw themselves in this movement. And I was like, that's really powerful. Because if we do if we sort of go back in time, go back in the DeLorean for a moment, it's pretty remarkable that 2 weeks before she became the presumptive candidate for the Democratic Party, people were discounting her like crazy. When they were like, yo, Joe needs to step out. He's about bow out. And we have a long list of people who should be there. This person, that person, that person. It was like, maybe Kamala Harris, maybe. And she went from that to like, I'm in this with her. I'm for her. And like this massive influx of energy. That didn't come from the one thing she said. It was a byproduct of all the memes, all the text and the meta text that people were creating and building on top of each other to create this cacophony of cultural momentum by which people go, oh, maybe I should pay attention to this, or maybe I should be on board with this because people like me are on board with this as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember trying to like shake my family and friends and say, you don't understand, these fan cams are important. They're essentially like a mashup sizzle video of someone that you love and adore with like a very fun song in the background and usually some interesting edits and like a color over on top. It's a digital equivalent of having a poster in your bedroom of someone.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Yeah. I think of it as it's cultural production. It's the work of the collection of people who self-identify by their particular fandom.
Yes. And as a result, it's a bumper sticker. It's
exactly
the poster. And that's right. It's how this generation, especially younger ones that are digital natives, really speak and show their support. They're not going to wear a button on their shirt, they're going to retweet memes and create memes. So I totally understand that. And I think it was very notable to me as well. It's interesting too, because on the other end, I do think that the Trump campaign has a history of being incredibly meme-centric and meme-forward, and also having a good understanding of their audience. I know that Trump gets made fun of a lot for his dancing. And at the RNC, they had a whole section of like, a fan cam sizzle video of his bad dancing that people all laughed and celebrated. they're very culturally online, both on both ends.
1000%. I mean, he is a walking meme. I mean, like, you know,
he's hysterical. He is really funny.
He says things.
She is too.
He says things that either people feel but are afraid to say, or things that people will never say because they don't feel that. And either one, whether you are on the spectrum, they create exogenous shocks to the system that get people talking. You know, so if he says things that you feel, you go, oh man, I'm gonna retweet that, or I'm gonna post that, or I'm gonna do a reaction video to that. If he says something that you don't agree with that actually infuriates you, you make a video for that, or you repost it, or you say something. And each one of these moments are opportunities for people to contribute to the cultural discourse. And as a result, we collectively make meaning. And those whose content, whose fan cams are most aligned with me, I go, that's my guy, or that's my girl. And it goes back to how it makes us feel, how it reverberates in our hearts, in our minds, how those things reverberate. And ultimately, those things decide what we do.
Yeah, it all goes back to emotion.
That's all it is.
Do you have a favorite meme from this campaign?
Oh, wow. I say this is not my favorite, but I thought that this was probably the hookiest one. It was Kamala's brat.
Oh, so good.
I mean, it was so powerful because it was extremely timely and it benefited from all the other things that people were saying was brat. And there was this constant hook that went back into Kamala Harris, because if this is brat and Kamala Harris is brat, then this must be good. Then Kamala Harris must be good. It's like it just caught the zeitgeist at the perfect time. We're having a brat summer. It was a part of our discourse. And then all that built-in equity was then transferred over to Kamala Harris. It was really, really powerful.
Yeah. I've used concepts of a plan with my boss. Absolutely. Right. Since right. I will say on the brat piece of it, two things, just, you know, a lot of marketers listen to this, and I think two things went really well. One, I think a lot of brands would try to jump into the brat conversation, right? I think the internet culture and the way we would probably advise a brand even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would be like, hack the feed, insert yourself into culture, disrupt. That's not what people want anymore. Young people are highly online. They're incredibly sophisticated marketers, and they want people to patron culture with them. Be online with me, be in the comments. And so I think what they did that was so smart was participate in that culture. So that's the first thing I think they did so well. They didn't try to just insert themselves. They joined something that was existing, but then they really weren't afraid to embrace it wholeheartedly. I think a lot of brands would maybe dip a toe and then leave, but I think mainly probably because time was of the essence and she had 90 days to run a campaign. They went all in on brat with the timeline, with their icon, with all the music that they were choosing to use. It was, they didn't shy away from a decision that was big and bold. And I think that can be learned from as well.
1000%. If there's any takeaway from a cultural lens, it's this, and you've laid it out perfectly, is that you don't hack into culture. You don't tap into culture, right? That is an exploitative approach to thinking about one's participation in culture. You engage in culture. And how do you engage? You have to have a point of view about the world. You have to have some conviction, some North Star that's greater than what you do. I mean, as soon as you start seeing brands go, my pizza is a brat, you go, okay, we're done here. That was fun. It was fun until you said that.
Yeah, right? Once
you
do that,
you ruined everything. We're done. You know, but having a point of view allows you to engage in the discourse in a meaningful way. And those who lead culture, these are people who actually create new language. They create new things. They push things forward. So to the example of brat and a concept of a plan, like Kamala is brat, is participating in the discourse. Concept of a plan is leading the discourse with new language. And that's a powerful thing.
Amazing. I'm obsessed with our meme conversation. I just want to know from you, you're an expert in this field. You literally study this. You are a doctor. Where do you see this going from here, especially culture as it relates to politics? What are we in for?
You know, I wrote a piece on Tuesday afternoon before we knew anything. it was all about social solidarity. We got to come together. We are one country. We are the things, all the things. Then after the results came out, and I just saw like the discourse that was happening on both sides. And I go, oh man, I don't know if I believe that so much. I don't know if the utopic view of who we are is as real as I hoped it to be. I mean, the truth of the matter is that I think there's a ton of distance. There's a gap. There's a gulf between the way a group of people in the country see the world and the other half of the country see the world. I think to myself, what the literature would say is that who we are today is divided. The question we have to ask ourselves is, who do we want to be? That's the question. How do we go forward? First starts with us doing inventory and deciding, who do we want to be? And that will inform the steps forward. Because if we want to continue to be divorced ideologically, then I'd say this is the start of what will be our future until we decide to that we actually want to see the world more similarly than we do and disparately. That will require us changing our identity markers from being Republican, Democrat, Independent to being Americans. And then what does it mean to be an American?
Yeah. And what does it mean when someone or a group of people who have felt undervalued are in the most valuable office in the world? When the anti-establishment becomes the establishment, what is the story evolution from there? We're not watching TV. These are our real lives, but how do you progress?
The framing of the question almost answers it. If we are anti-establishment, then this is about destroying the established institutions that exist. And the question becomes, who does it benefit and who does it eradicate?
A lot to think about. That is all the time we have, but thank you so, so much, Marcus, for your insights, your expertise. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.